Our scripture reading this morning is found in the Gospel of Mark, and we're reading in chapter 7. I invite you to follow along with us as we read. Mark chapter 7, verses 1 to 23. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" And he said to them, "Well, did Isaiah prophesy of you, hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commands of men.' You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." And he said to them, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and 'Whoever reviles father or mother must surely die.' But you say, 'If a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is Corban, that is, given to God,' then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father and mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And many such things you do." And he called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him." And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, "Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled?" Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, "What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile us." May the Lord add to this reading of his word today.
Living at this point of history, I have taken for granted the ability and the knowledge of soap and being able to wash our hands. You see, our modern understanding of pathogens and germs and they being a cause of what makes us sick, and how washing of hands assists in killing pathogens so that we don't get sick, this is modern knowledge, fairly recent knowledge in the whole course of history, appearing only approximately 150 years ago. You see, prior to 1870, doctors had no problem performing an autopsy on a corpse, dicing and cutting and discovering, and then leaving that autopsy and moving into the maternity ward to assist with their hands unwashed ladies to give birth. So that in one particular hospital, it was known that 10% of the women who were admitted to give birth there would die simply because of the transference of disease and or pieces of corpses to these women. They called it childbirth fever. But it wasn't a fever whatsoever. It was infection because the doctors did not wash their hands. And so with that little bit of history, I now have a greater appreciation for how, when I was growing up, and as we grow up, people telling us, or our parents telling us, wash your hands before you eat, and the availability of soap, and all this washing our hands. This is common knowledge for us, this hygiene, this simple hygiene. Yet, as crucial as hand washing is for hygiene, this is not the concern of the Pharisees and the scribes in Mark chapter 7, verse 2, when they notice Jesus' disciples not eating with their hands having been washed. That's not their concern at all. Their concern, the matter involves dwelling with and approaching God. That's their concern. You see, remember that when God made a covenant with Israel, and Israel made the covenant with God back with Moses at Mount Sinai. God says, I'll be your people, God said, I'll be your God, and the people said, you'll be our God. Part of that agreement was that God was going to dwell among them in the camp. God was going to live amongst them. His presence would be there, and that would be in the tabernacle at first. And then later, when they got settled in the land, that would be at the temple. But God isn't just any kind of God. He's a holy God. And therefore, those who among whom he will dwell, or those who are going to approach him, they must be holy also. For God is holy. Therefore, they must be like him if he is to dwell in their camp. Therefore, God said to the Israelites that they had to be morally and ritually, ceremonially clean or pure if they're going to approach God or if they're going to dwell in the camp where God dwells. And he gave a number of different things that they could understand and how they had to be prepared to be clean. Now, in Leviticus chapters 11 through to 15, and Numbers 19, it describes how an Israelite could become unfit, disqualified to approach God through a physical means, not a moral means, but through a physical means. If they had touched a dead body, if a woman has given birth, if they have bodily discharges, if they have certain skin diseases, God says, okay, physically, ceremonially, ritually, you're barred from coming towards me. Or if with some of them, like leprosy, the skin diseases, they had to leave the camp. They couldn't even be in the same camp where God was. Let's just take a look at one of these examples. Leviticus chapter 15, verses 2, 4, and 6. Speaks about bodily discharges. Verse 2 of Leviticus 15, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean. Verse 4, every bed on which the one with the discharge lies shall be unclean, and everything on which he sits shall be unclean. Verse 6, and whoever sits on anything which the one with the discharge has sat shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean till evening. So even if you had not committed a moral sin, such as an act of unkindness or lying or cheating, you could become ritually unfit to approach God through some physical contact in the marketplace if you sat on a bench where someone else who had been unclean sat, you would become defiled. You would become unclean, and therefore you would need to wash and wait until evening before you could approach God. Yet, with our knowledge of pathogens today and disease and germs, we can see how a lot of these laws actually help stop some of the spread of disease. But again, that's not the concern of the Pharisees. The concern of the Pharisees and the scribes is that as they've been out in the marketplace and rubbed shoulders with people in the crowd and went and touched different things, they're concerned that they have touched someone or some object that has defiled them and made them ritually unclean so they can no longer approach God. Noting the concern in Mark chapter 7 of eating with unwashed and defiled hands in verse 5, and then noting Jesus' reply in verses 14 and following, we can see that the scribes and the Pharisees had a particular belief. The belief was that that outer defilement, they could pick it up from touching someone in the marketplace or an object, and that they could touch it, and then that uncleanliness would be on their hands. And then as they touched their food, that uncleanliness would be transferred to their food. Then if they consumed the food, they would become unclean on the inside. So the Pharisees, to prevent this more serious uncleanliness of the inside, when they come back from the marketplace, they had all these ritualistic ceremonial washings relating to their hands, to their body, to the plates, to the cups, to the furniture that is associated with food. Anything related to food. They would go through all these laborious, detailed, specific washings. And in their mind, if you followed all these rules and laws of washing, then you'll be pure. You'll be able to come before God. You will have gotten rid of yourself, of the defilement you picked up in the marketplace. Oh, where were all these laws? They're part of what is called the oral law. We talked about this earlier in the Gospel of Mark when we looked at Jesus and his conflict with the Pharisees over the Sabbath. You know, the Pharisees had all these laws about what you could do or could not do, what was work, wasn't work on the Sabbath. And that was part of this large body of laws and traditions called the oral law. Well, it also has a huge section on all these washings, describing it all in detail. The thing that I didn't mention before, that I should mention now, is that these oral laws that were passed down from generation to generation orally, and eventually they were written down in the 2nd century A.D., but the rabbinic tradition, or the tradition of the rabbis, was that these oral laws were given at the same time as the written law of Moses. Some of the rabbis believed and taught that when God gave Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the written law, God also gave to Moses and to Israel these oral laws, but they were never written down and just passed on orally. And over hundreds of years, over centuries, they would add an explanations of how these laws would be lived out and what they should do. Now, the interesting thing is, as we see from Jesus' response in verses 8 and 9, Jesus denies that these oral laws came from God. What does he call them? He does not say, "You're breaking where these oral laws of washing are related to the laws of God." He doesn't say they're the laws of God. He simply calls them the traditions of men. So we come into Jesus' response. The first part of Jesus' response. Notice he is not dealing with he doesn't actually deal with the washing of hands. He doesn't respond to that specific issue. He responds to the deeper or the more significant issue, the breaking, the accusation of he's breaking tradition, of which the Pharisees gave an example. "Your disciples are not washing their hands." He says, "How come you don't follow the elders' tradition? The whole kit and caboodle of it. You know, that's the real issue. Why are you breaking that?" And as the Pharisees ask Jesus this question, realize that they're insinuating that Jesus is not a good teacher, that Jesus is not leading his disciples in the right way and in the things of God. Because you're breaking the traditions of the elders, which many of them understood the oral law to be equal in authority to the written law of God. We need to note something. while God had commanded all the Israelites to wash with water after they touched a dead body or after they had a discharge from their body, they were to wash after that. All the Israelites were. And then wait until evening. But you will find nowhere in the law of God that all the Israelites had to wash their hands before they ate. The only time that you find commands in the written law that God gave to Israel relating to food and washing is connected to the priests and their families. They are found in two spots. The first is in Exodus chapter 30, verse 17 to 21. And that's where God says to the priests, if you're going, when you come to the altar and offer me the food offerings, then wash your feet and hands before you present the food offering to me. And the second passage is Leviticus 22, which is also expanded in Numbers 18, is a situation where God has given the certain sacrifices. Okay, the people of Israel give sacrifices to God and grain offerings and food to God. Then God gave a significant portion of those sacrifices and food offerings to the priests and their family. That was their wages. That was because they didn't have a regular job to earn money, so God gave them a portion of the offerings to them to take home to feed their families. And explains that because the offering has been given to God, it's holy. Therefore, when they take it home, their family members, before they eat it, need to be ceremonially clean. So if they're ceremonially unclean, they need to wash, wait till evening, and then they may partake of the meal. They may eat of the offering. That's all that it says about food and food offerings. So you see, water and food offerings, or washing and food offerings. So it only relates to the priests, but not to all of Israel. So this is why we can see in the first part of Jesus' response, he says, you're just following traditions of men. These are not the laws of God. And he's very scathing here, and he says, you've actually rejected God's law. And you are using your traditions to break the law of God. And the example he gives here, he cites from Exodus 20:12 and 21:17, where he is referring to the command to honor your mother and father and not to revile them. And he says, you actually break that law with your traditions because of your tradition called Corban. What is Corban? Corban, I guess we can explain it. It's similar to our concept of deferred giving. So you take a portion of your property or a portion of your estate or your finances, and you say, I will set that aside so that at a certain time in the future, it shall be given to this charity or this cause or this purpose. But it's still yours. You can use it until then, but you can't sell it, and you can't, you know, give it away to others because you have deferred, or legally you're obligated to give it to what you have set it aside for. So in a similar idea, Corban was like that. They would take part of their property or possessions, and they would say, well, this is for God later on. I dedicate it to him, but until then, they could use it for themselves. The problem came is because in that day, adult children are supposed to look after their parents. They don't have old age pension, they have any pensions. There's no help from the government. So when you got old in your old age, usually it was your adult children who provided for you and assisted you if you needed it. So Jesus is saying, you are causing people, through your tradition of Corban, when their elderly parents get into trouble, you prevent them from selling off part of the property that they said has been dedicated to God through this vow of Corban, and you cause them to leave their parents in poverty or whatever, without aid. So they do not honor their parents for your tradition called Corban. So this is how they break the law of God with their tradition. Then the second part of Jesus' response moves us into verses 14 down to 23. Now he actually brings the crowds out. He starts to talk to the crowds. He's not just talking to the scribes and the Pharisees. And he explains to the disciples and the people that he says, look, the source of defilement, what makes us unclean or unfit to be in the presence of God? What defiles us so that we can't approach God? He says the source of that is not from outside ourselves, but the source of that is actually within. What defiles us is our very own heart, our very own nature, that which is inside us, our being. Now, when it speaks of the heart here, we must not read a weak modern understanding of heart into this. You know, we in our modern understanding of heart, we often think of, you know, these anatomically incorrect red shapes and Valentine's Day and often concepts of romance and stuff like that. Rather weak. What the heart is talking about often in Scripture, the concept of heart scripturally, usually is a reference to the entire inner person and personality. It's not merely referring to some emotion or romance and cute stuff. It's referring to who you are. So the heart, when you look at the Scriptures and the various verses that speak of the heart, it is the center of our thinking, our desires, our values, our decision-making, our will, our emotions, and our morals. So in other words, it's the place where everything is decided and everything is, it's the command center, the control center of who we are. And therefore, the heart then determines all our outward actions and all our outward behavior. And so that's what Jesus is saying. You want to know what defiles us? It comes from the command center. It comes from the core of who we are. And it works its way out. The Baker Encyclopedia of the Bible sums up the biblical data on the heart this way. For the heart signifies the total inner self, a person's hidden core of being. It is the genuine self distinguished from the appearance, the public position, the physical presence. End of quote. So it's the real us. That's what the heart is. We may have an outer, exterior, an appearance that isn't necessarily the real us. But the heart is referring to the real us, our true character and being and nature. So understanding this properly, what the heart is, we can understand that Jesus is implying or saying these following three things. First of all, he's saying it's our private inner self, the real you and I, which is the source of all our wickedness that defiles us. We cannot live in God's presence. We cannot approach God, not because of something that has contaminated us from without, but because of who we are inside, who we are in nature. That's why we cannot live with God, because we're wicked by nature. You know that the uniform witness of the Scriptures is the heart is wicked, the human heart is wicked. You may know of these very famous verses from the Old Testament that are quoted often. Jeremiah chapter 17, verses 9 to 10. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his deeds. The second thing that we can understand Jesus saying here is that the elders' traditions, all those ritual washings with water related to food, they don't deal with the real issue. They don't deal with the inner corruption of the heart. They might wash off the stuff they've picked up from the marketplace, but that doesn't make them fit to come before God, because all those external washings don't deal with the source of true defilement, the source of a wicked heart. The Pharisees, the scribes, their emphasis with their oral traditions and their traditions of the elders are all focused on externals. It's all focused on appearance. They've done the right rituals. They've done the right ceremonies. But inwardly, the inward person is seething, pumping out wickedness. They're hypocrites. They're worshiping outwardly. But inwardly, they are separated from God. As Jesus says, you are far, far from God. And the third thing is Jesus is now realigning us to the proper and true standards of purity. So don't misunderstand Jesus. When Jesus dismisses all these traditions of the elders and says, oh, your washings before you eat and all the washing of the bowls and the furniture, he says, that's a bunch of nonsense. Don't think that Jesus is now making things easier. He's not. Actually, he's showing us the true reality, which is much more severe and much more difficult. He's actually saying that what really ruins a relationship with God is not because you touched an unclean person in the marketplace and then touched your food and ate it. He's saying the real source, the real problem is inside. How are you going to clean that up? William Lane puts it well, and I quote, "By this interpretation, Jesus does not alleviate the demand for purity, but sharpens it. The capacity for fellowship with God is not destroyed by material uncleanliness of food or hands. It's destroyed by personal sin." End of quote. So you see now how, wow, it is definitely, he's sharpened what is needed to be done. It's easy to wash a bunch of pots and pans and hands and bodies. But what are we going to do with the inner purity? How do we wash our character? How do we change our nature? So we come to two practical applications that I want to put forward to you this morning. Number one, don't blame external conditions and environment for your own sin, which is your own responsibility. Popular culture and academic social theory that is taught in our academies is basically this: we are born with a good nature, or we're born with a blank slate. That's what people believe and teach in our educational systems today. You're born good, or you're born with a blank slate, and then depending on your environment and how you grow up, that affects you and determines whether, you know, you do stuff that's good or you do stuff that is bad. It's further promoted that the wickedness that you do is caused by your environment or conditions in which you have grown up. Well, largely, that's all nonsense. It's unscriptural. It's not true. It is true that we are affected by our environment and our experiences of life, but our own thoughts, our own responses, our own choices, and our own behavior to and in those conditions, both good responses and bad and wicked responses, are our own responsibility. And they have come from our heart. And we cannot lay the blame on anybody else for our actions and our behavior and our speech. So we cannot blame the dysfunctional, we can't blame our dysfunctional family. Well, I'm this way because my family was dysfunctional. I'm this way because I grew up in poverty. I'm this way because I've been bullied, etc., etc. On and on it goes. Blame everybody for our actions. Now, that's not to diminish the evil that has been done to us. But we cannot say, because we have had rotten things done to us, therefore, whatever rotten and evil things I do in response, I'm not responsible for. We cannot say that. Because it's very clear. The wicked stuff that we do comes from our own wicked desires and nature. Remember Adam, the very first man. When Adam and Eve sinned, and God called the two of them to account, And God said, you know, hey, Adam, what happened here? What, did you guys eat of the tree? What was Adam's response? Genesis chapter 3, verse 12. The man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree and I ate. So what was Adam doing? What was Adam's excuse? What was the reason for his eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and fruit and evil that God says, do not eat of this tree, for the day you surely eat of it, you will die. What was his excuse for his eating? Her, and she gave it to me. And actually, you know, it's your fault because you made the woman and you gave her to me. And what, does God accept that kind of blame, that shifting of Adam's blame? No. What does God say in verse 17? Because you have listened to the voice of your wife. You didn't have to listen, Adam. You could have chosen differently. You could have chosen not to eat. You ate that all by yourself. And therefore, he appropriately punished him. So we must not blame external conditions and environments and others for our own sin. That is our responsibility because it comes from within. It does not come from without. Second thing, human hearts, natures, and persons need to be transformed by God for us to live with him. The ancient nation of Israel became so wicked that God couldn't live with them anymore. He couldn't dwell with them. They decided to have other gods, and they broke the covenant. So that meant God had to bring the covenant curses upon them. They knew that when they made the agreement with God, that if they forsook God and worshipped other gods, he would dismantle them as a nation, and so he did. And those that survived the famines and the wars were scattered among all different types of other nations for 70 years. And the interesting thing is that God didn't leave them scattered. And it was not for their sake. It was for his own name, the glory of his own name, God said, I will bring some of you back after 70 years and put you back in the land. I'm not doing this because you deserve it. You don't. You deserve to be destroyed and permanently destroyed as a nation. And no longer my people ever again. That's what they deserve. So, but God says, for my glory, I will take some of you and I'll put you back in the land and I will deal with your wicked heart. And we have it written in Ezekiel chapter 36. These words. Verses 25 to 27. So after speaking about bringing them back from the different nations, it says this, I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean from all your uncleanlinesses, and from all your idols I will cleanse you. And I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh, and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules. The language of the New Testament puts it just a little bit differently, but it's referring to the same thing, this radical heart surgery. In the language of the New Testament, it speaks about what? A new nature, a new self, being a new creation in Jesus. It speaks of being regenerated. Regenerated means to make alive again. It speaks of being born again. Same concept. Being made new, cleansed from the inside out. Being made whole from the inside out. You see, what God offered the disobedient exiles of Israel, he offers in Jesus Christ to all of us, to all people. So if we're tired and wearied of our guilt and our sin and our shame and the burden of being sinful and corrupt on the inside, then Jesus is the one who can do something about it. You can't turn over a new leaf. Doesn't work, because the leaf just comes from a rotten tree. You have to replace the tree. We need a new heart, a new being. So you just try to reform your behavior through ritualistic ceremonies, through an attempt at good behavior and obeying a bunch of religious laws. It won't work. Do you desire that something could be done about the evil that wells up within your own inner person? Do you want to approach God? Do you want to know Him? Do you want to find forgiveness, release from condemnation? You see, having disobeyed God, we are condemned already. John 3:18 tells us, if we have not believed in His Son, we are condemned to hell already. The sentence has already been passed upon the sinner, the one with the wicked heart. If we want to have release from that, if we want to find new life, peace, the ability to do what is really good, then only radical heart surgery can do something about that. Only a complete transformation and removal of our old nature and replacement with a new nature, a new inner self, is required. And only God can do that. Only He can do that. And God has promised to perform this radical surgery, this making us alive, raising us from the dead, spiritual deadness. He's going to make us spiritually alive. He will forgive our sin and bring us into fellowship and give us His own righteousness so that we could live with Him. If we will but first of all admit that we are corrupt, that we are rotten inside, that we have disobeyed His laws, that we are sinners. That's where we have to start. We have to say this, yeah, your diagnosis, God, is right. It's what we are. And I want to repent. I want to change. I want to leave all that. I want to follow You. I want You to make me a new person. I give up on all my externals, all my religious laws, and all my attempts to do what is good. Forget it. It won't work because the core is rotten. So I give up all my self-effort, recognizing that I could attend church all my life, help a million old ladies across the street, and I will go straight to hell. Nothing will help. I can't change myself. It's You. And You can change me because You did what was necessary at the cross. What You did, that work at the cross, is the basis for why You can change me, why You can forgive me. Because You exchanged places with me. At the cross, You took my sin and my penalty of death, and You bore it in my place. And then after rising from the dead, You are willing to give me the righteousness that I lack, Your own perfect righteousness, so that I can be in the presence of God. So I ask that You would grant that to me. It's by grace we are saved, not by works. Grace, undeserved favor of God, based on the work of Jesus at the cross. So if you want to be a new person, you want to have that radical heart surgery that only God can do, then this is how you need to respond to the great surgeon. I'm a sinner. Save me. I want to leave the sin. I receive You as my Lord, my King, my God. Forgive me, transform me, renew me. Grant me a new heart, a new person. Make me a new person, and let me follow You all the rest of my days. That's what a true Christian really is. If you want to define a Christian is someone who is a new person, changed from the inside out by God's grace, who have responded to Him in faith and trust that He has done what is necessary to make us new and make us fit to come into His presence and dwell with Him. I leave you with these words of Jesus. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. Do not marvel that I said to you, you must be born again. Please be seated.